From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Barack Obama strongly denounces his former pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright. The Supreme Court backs an Indiana law requiring voters to show a picture ID at their polling place. And Senators Hillary Clinton and John McCain find themselves on the same side of a proposal that would give drivers a break from paying gas taxes. For more on this week's news, we have Mary Frances Berry, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. She is also the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. Also with us, Robert Trainum, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network, CN8. Welcome, folks.
Come over here. Thank you, Farai. Hello.
Hi, Mary.
So Reverend Wright put himself in the spotlight. He gave two speeches and one interview in the course of 4 days. And then yesterday, Barack Obama gave a speech denouncing Reverend Wright. Let's take a listen.
I am outraged by the comments that were made and saddened over the spectacle that we saw yesterday. You know, I have been a member of Trinity United Church of Christ since 1992. I've known Reverend Wright for almost 20 years. The person I saw yesterday was not the person that I met 20 years ago.
In a way, it sounds like a divorce. Mary, is this the end of Obama and Wright's two-decade-long relationship?
Well, it appears to be the end unless and until he gets to be president. That is Obama, not Wright, in any case. And I think he really did divorce him. I mean, it's over. It's not a separation. And he was emphatic about it. There are still questions left, like, what did he know and when did he know it and when did Obama find out that the guy made sermons like that? All that stuff is left. But I think for the supporters of Obama, he made a clean break with Reverend Wright, and that should no longer be an issue for them.
Robert, if it was the right decision, at least in terms of presidential politics, why did it take so long?
I think for two reasons, Farai. First and foremost, you know, yes, it was a divorce, but it was also a funeral, because if you take a look at Senator Obama's posture, you can tell that he was really struggling for words and really trying to put this into some type of context from an emotional standpoint. And the reason being is because apparently they had a relationship for 20 years. And remember, you know, this was his spiritual advisor. This is someone that married him. This is someone that baptized his children and presumably walked him through the spiritual aspects of his life. And so for someone to come out in such a personal way to quote-unquote mock and disrespect Senator Obama, you know, it was pretty hard for him. But to answer your question specifically, Farai, you know, Senator Obama, it took him a long time because I think he was really trying to search for the right answers to this and for all the reasons that I just spoke about. This is a very painful situation when your quote-unquote spiritual advisor does what he did in such a public way. You know, it wasn't, you know, everyone has the right to defend themselves. And obviously Reverend Wright had the right to do that. But to do it in a mocking way, to do it literally all around the country, starting in Detroit and then going to Washington, D.C., and doing it in such a almost a spectacle, it was a circus, I think Senator Obama clearly had to come out and say what he had to say.
Farai, I think that Reverend Wright believed that he had been disrespected, whether we agree with that or not, that he had been disrespected by his 20-year-long parishioner who distanced himself from him in public. And he has a large ego, Reverend Wright does, and is well known in the religious community as being a powerful theologian, and thinks that he has his own reputation to defend. And feeling disrespected by his long-term parishioner, I think he decided that he would diss him. That was not a wise political decision, and I'm not sure, I don't think he's political at all, and I'm not sure he knows anything about PR. I would say that based on watching him. But I think that that was what was going on there, and so then Obama had to turn around and diss him, as we say. That is, shove him aside, and that's what he did.
Well, Farai, just not to belabor this point, but as I think Mary just butchers my point, I mean, this is a very complicated relationship. There's no question about it, both from a generational standpoint, but also on a black, quote-unquote, black-on-black perspective. And clearly, Reverend Wright was beating to his own tune, and Senator Obama clearly had to beat to his own tune.
Do you think, Mary, that the white swing voters that are going to be so critical in the upcoming two contests in North Carolina and Indiana are going to look at this and say, oh, finally, this is great, we're glad? Or is it not going to change the equation?
Well, I don't know, obviously, but the news clips and the that I looked at today and on the internet, the responses, people said things like, "What did he know and when did he know it? And did he know about these sermons before the even when he announced? Because that's the reason why he didn't want Reverend Wright in public outside when he announced in Springfield." They're asking questions like that, and why is he he's doing it now? Because he has to. We'll have to see how many people are persuaded. The Obama supporters are okay, but the question is, as you put it, how many of these swing voters will say, whatever the history is, whatever happened before now, he has clearly laid this aside. It is, though, it depends on what Reverend Wright does, too. We don't know whether Reverend Wright will now fire back and say something, or we don't know if a bunch of black pastors will come out and defend Reverend Wright. So it just depends on what happens. If there's silence in the next few days on this subject, perhaps some of those voters will accept what he said.
Please
go ahead briefly, and then I want to move on to the gas tax.
Senator Obama has a problem. He has a problem with white middle-class voters. We saw that in Ohio. We certainly saw it in Pennsylvania. So going into North Carolina and Indiana, he recognizes that this is the last thing that he needs right now. And that's the main reason why he came out so swiftly to denounce Reverend Wright's comments.
I want to ask you, Robert, about this idea of a gas tax holiday. The presumptive Republican nominee, John McCain, wants to eliminate the federal gas tax from Memorial Day to Labor Day. That means that if you go and fill up your tank, you would get a cut of 18.4 cents a gallon on gasoline sold and 24 cents on diesel sold. So give me a quick run through of how the candidates pan out on this, the presidential candidates.
Well, ironically, Senator Clinton has a very similar plan to Senator McCain. Senator Obama does not support this plan, and the reason why is because the federal gas tax directly funds highway as well as bridges construction and also maintaining those roads. Senator Obama specifically says that it's not going to do a lot of good simply because you're only save about $3 or $4 when you fill up your tank from a tax perspective. But also too, those are badly needed funds to maintain our roads. He also says, Senator Obama also says, that it actually could raise gas prices in terms of supply and demand. Senator McCain and Clinton vehemently deny that. So there really is an issue between whether or not this 20 cents or 24 cents or whatever the number really is, really does that save any money in the long run?
Fariah, I think that it is short-sighted to oppose the gas tax holiday in a political sense. In practical terms and whatever the economics are, for people like me who can afford to buy gas and people who can afford to buy whatever amount of gas they need, and even hope that there will be a long-term solution to this overuse of gas problem, it's okay. But for people who are working-class types, some of those very voters in Indiana and North Carolina and places, who for $3 or $4 is a lot of money to them, and who worry and who want a short-term solution, and who this summer had plans to go someplace, the truck drivers who are upset about it, all these people. It's one of those cases where if you're part of an elite and you can afford to do things, you think that it's minimal to do something for people who are poor. But for people who are struggling to buy bread or to buy groceries or with prices up on everything else, they may think it's not that we don't want in the long run to do something that makes sense, but in the short term, even if we can get a few pennies or a few dollars off. So I may turn out to be wrong about that, but I would think that the consensus among working class types who are not well off would be that they'd appreciate anything anybody could do for them in the short term.
And Farai, you know, that's a very interesting point, because if you take a look at the demographics of where Senator Clinton needs to go, she needs to go with more white middle to lower middle class individuals, and that's the same constituency that Barack Obama needs to go after. And it's ironic that Barack Obama is often called now in the press elitist and out of touch and aloof. So you would think that to kind of counterbalance that, he would actually go after these very voters with some type of a gas tax plan, as Mary had mentioned, for those folks that are living literally from paycheck to paycheck.
We have a short window left to talk about one final issue, and that's voter ID. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to overturn the Indiana law that requires voters to show government-issued photo ID at the polls. Now, Robert, why did the court uphold this law, and are other states following suit?
other Republican states where there's a legislature in control of the Republicans will probably follow suit, and the reason why is because it clearly benefits Republican candidates around the country. The reason why the Supreme Court did this is because they uphold a lowercase law, and they also said in a reasonable case, look, you go to a bank, when you cash a check, you have to show a government-issued ID. They really wanted to tap down, or at least try to tamp down, on government fraud, or at least voter fraud, as it relates to people that have been dead for 5 or 10 years voting, people that may have lived in multiple states voting. That's not widespread, but in certain parts of the country, it is a problem, and the Supreme Court wanted to address that issue.
Farai, the Election Assistance Commission and the DOJ Civil Rights Division, even under this administration, have said that there have not been any major fraud cases, that this is just something that people talk about and put out there, but they say that there haven't been any, so I accept that. The other reason, the other thing that's happening with the court decided this technically because they said there was no denial of equal protection and states' rights permit this. The practical reason why they did it is because there are Reagan-Bush judges who are in the majority, that we got Roberts, Alito, all those people in the majority on the court who feel this way, and they got, you know, Stevens go with them. And that's why the decision came out the way it did. And again,
Is it actually going to hurt some voters?
Yes, it will hurt. It will hurt poor people. It will hurt disabled people. Here's how it hurts them. If they don't have government-issued ID and they have to sign a provisional ballot when they go to vote, they have to go to the courthouse, which in some cases is far away. This was from an Indiana case, far away from where they live, in order to verify their identity before their votes can be cast. Many of them don't have transportation. It's a long way to go. What it is really will suppress. It's one of those things that sounds logical and rational and like anybody could do it, and why not? But it's one of those things that suppresses the poor and those who can least afford to pay.
Well, Mary,
right, I know we're out of time.
We are
out of time. I know we're out of time. 6-3 with the Supreme Court decision, just to be fair.
Okay. All right. Mary, Robert, thanks so much.
Stevens.
All right, guys. Mary Frances Berry is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, also the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. And Robert Tranum is the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network CN8. They both joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Reverend Wright strikes back. Listeners are firing up our blog with responses to the latest news about Barack Obama's former pastor. Our web producer, Jeff Bennett, has more. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Farai.
So Barack Obama finally, what some would say, disavowed Reverend Wright following the pastor's recent media blitz. What are folks saying on our blog?
Well, everybody has an opinion. Now, here's a sampling. Bill M. wrote, "I don't fault Reverend Wright for expressing his long-held beliefs and views. What is surprising is how some in the black community are rushing to muzzle him for the sake of political expediency." Another reader named G. Glover wrote, "For me, the Obama campaign needs to learn how to deal with adverse publicity, no matter what the source." And the blogger Audio Dramatist said that if black folks have an interest in seeing Obama elected, he wrote in our blog, "the current task is to protect him, not speak for him, not question him, and certainly not shine a light on ourselves at his expense. Let the brother," meaning Obama, "do his thing." And we have an installment of Speak Your Mind. News and Notes listeners Jared Lodeholt and Mary C. Curtis share their views and rights comments.
All right. I'll check that out. Now, also earlier this week, we covered the acquittals of the New York police detectives involved in the shooting death of 23-year-old Sean Bell. What are people writing about on that?
Well, they're writing about our coverage of it on Monday's Bloggers Roundtable segment. Police fired 50 rounds at Bell, and on our show there was some discussion about whether the number of shots fired was significant. So here's what one of the bloggers had to say.
I mean, if you can get killed by one shot, I mean, to me, the first shot is the one that matters, and that's the one that needs to be scrutinized. The other 49, I mean, they're bad marksmanship.
So that was blogger Jim Collier. And in response, a reader named Malik said that comment was totally off base. He wrote, "There is never any justification to shoot someone 50 times. Not even an animal is shot 50 times. But John Poeta, another reader, wrote, 50 rounds or 100 rounds, you shoot until the threat is neutralized, period.
Alrighty,
so there you
then.
Go.
Well, what else has people fired up on the News and Views site?
Well, there's a story that's been bubbling online involving the group Planned Parenthood allegedly targeting a minority woman for abortion, so we've tried to parse that out on our site. And the state of Florida might allow its drivers to purchase Christian-themed driver's licenses, or license plates, rather. So folks can join in the conversation at newsandviews.org or check out our Facebook page.
All right. Jeffrey, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me from our studios at NPR West. Some political minds ask if Barack Obama's campaign staff has enough color. Plus, actor Wesley Snipes gets ready for his prison stripes. We've got that and more on today's Bloggers Roundtable. With us, media consultant Carmen Dixon. She writes the blog All About Race. Wayne Bennett, an attorney who blogs as The Field Negro, and freelance journalist Danielle Belton. She runs the blogs Black Snob and The Secret Council of American Negroes. Welcome, everybody.
Hi, Farai.
Hi, Farai.
Hi, Farai.
So let's start with this story CBS ran last week called Inside Barack Obama's War Room. Several bloggers have made the observation that no black or brown faces were seen in that Katie Couric piece. And some are wondering just how many people of color does Obama have on his campaign? So we reached out to the Obama campaign, and Candace Tolliver, senior communications strategist with Obama for America, said, quote, "We truly have one of the most diverse and talented teams in the history of presidential politics." She said they've got plenty of African-American staffers like senior advisor Valerie Jarrett, who's also a longtime personal friend of the Obamas. They've got political director Matt Nugent, senior advisor Earthaline Cousin, just to name a few. Now, Danielle, you're blogging about this now, and it's very funny the way you've approached it. You talk about your father playing a game called Spot the Black Person working for the Obama campaign.
Exactly.
Tell me about your dialogue, on and offline about this.
Well, what was surprising to me was basically how traditionally when you have like a Democratic candidate and even some cases a Republican candidate, there will often be like some, you know, black upstart, you know, shining star they make part of their campaign that kind of becomes like a launching pad. Like, for instance, you know, Amy Holmes, who is a Republican strategist who often appears on television, she got her start with Bill Frist's campaign. So my father would, you know, it started out with him trying to spot a black person, you know, being Barack's secret service duty person. And it just kind of branched into the whole, well, hey, I don't see any public, you know, PR type people, you know, speaking out for Barack. And I don't see, you know, anyone talking to the press, that are actually paid staff for the campaign. So he became really curious about it and he asked me about it. And, you know, I figured, well, hey, why don't I see if I could find out? And so it just seemed kind of startling to me, and especially to my dad, because his main concern was Barack trying too hard to try to appeal to a middle of the road or to a white affluent base to the point where he felt he couldn't be too close to black people lest he be labeled the black candidate.
Wayne, I mean, do you think that this is the kind of thing where some people aren't going to notice at all who is around a political candidate? Other folks will take very sharp notice. Do you think that this is the kind of thing? Well, I'll give a very different example. Oprah Winfrey's company, Harpo, was not cited as a black-run company because most of the executives at Harpo are white. This was by a research firm whose name, sadly, I cannot remember right now. But the whole question of black enough also applies to staffing when it comes to diversity. Is this something folks should be paying attention to?
Well, I'm tempted to say, you know, you always want to get the best people for the job. But in Obama's case, he obviously hasn't. I mean, the people that have been advising him, I don't know if they're black or white, but they certainly haven't been doing a very good job from what lately and certainly as it relates to Jeremiah Wright. But that's an interesting point. I never really thought about it until it was mentioned to discuss today. And I kind of looked at it myself. What I do notice when the candidates are on the stump or when they're speaking to a group is that I call it the product, the people placement in the back of the candidates when they're on stage. And I always wonder, like, do the campaigns control that? Because I noticed earlier on in Hillary Clinton's campaign, there were all these older people behind her, and then the crowd got younger and younger, and Barack's crowd got wider and wider as he tried to appeal to a certain demographic. So it's an interesting point, and I really, to be honest, don't know the inner workings of his campaign. I heard you saying that someone sent you something from his campaign about all the African-Americans that advise him. So I got to say, though, whoever it is, they're not doing a very good job. And I have heard that. I know, like, David Axelrod and the higher ranking people in his campaign are predominantly white. So it's an interesting subject, I must say.
Let me get Carmen in on this. On your blog, All About Race, you were asking if black folks will stay home in November if Obama doesn't get the Democratic nomination. So we've seen, you know, this issue of staffing come up. It may be a smaller issue in terms of mainstream appeal, but certainly the Reverend Jeremiah Wright issue has just been burning and burning and burning. What about the divisions? What are you writing about, and what level of division do you think there is within potential Democratic voters?
Well, I think we're a long way out from November. So I'll preface my answer that way. Right now, what I'm seeing and what I'm talking about with personal friends, is that we're of a consensus that we wouldn't vote for the Democratic candidate if it's not Barack Obama, if he is given a raw deal at the convention. Given the turnout, given what he has in sheer numbers, he should get the nomination. Now, on the other hand, McCain seems to be reaching out across the divide, even a little bit, which is intriguing. But personally, I've decided I'm going to vote for Barack Obama no matter what. If it's a write-in, then so be it. And I know that there are others who have a similar idea.
Is that echoing back to, you know, some elections where people say, spoiler, spoiler? I mean, what you're saying sounds like Barack Obama himself, if Senator Clinton gets the nomination, could become a spoiler.
Well, I take issue with the term spoiler. Even with Nader, I think anyone's allowed to run. Anyone is allowed to earn votes. That's the American way. Why is he a spoiler? None of us is entitled to the office of the presidency. You have to earn it.
All right, let me move on to speaking of earning it. I know, bad pun, but Wesley Snipes, he earned it, he kept it, and he got it. And that got it is his jail sentence. He was sentenced to 3 years in jail for failing to file his tax returns for several years in a row. He apologized for his actions, cut three checks of $5 million each, but it wasn't enough to sway the court. So, Wayne, on your blog, The Field Negro, you write, can't a brother get some love from Uncle Sam? So, I mean, you know, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know what? I happen to know a little bit about this. Was this judge was, I have to say, a little out of control. I mean, the prosecutor, I'm sure, was surprised themselves at the sentence they got in this case. And the judge pretty much made it clear in his trial that he was not going to be kind to Mr. Snipes. And given the fact that I know some people say, well, the case is a little different, but Willie Nelson got probation for owing, for cheating on over $1 million worth of taxes. And I mean, 3 years just seems a little excessive. I don't think he'll do a day by
the way. He owed $41 million.
Who did? Wesley Snipes. Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I think he should be punished, and he should pay it back. But I just thought 3 years was a little excessive, which I don't think he will do, by the way. I think they will be successful on their appeal.
Well, Wayne mentioned Willie Nelson, but there's also Mark Anthony, who last year agreed to pay $2.5 million in back taxes. Carmen, do you think there's a double standard, or is this just, look, you know, you death and taxes, and if you don't take care of the taxes, you're going to end up in the slammer?
I'm not so convinced it's a double standard, anything more than celebrity, non-celebrity, profile, non-profile, because this case was generating a lot of publicity even before it hit trial. There was this idea that Wesley Snipes was very adamant about and very militant, shall we say, with scare quotes around it, very militant about not needing to pay taxes. So sure enough, that judge wanted to smack him down and send a message to anyone else who might argue about paying taxes in this way. It's clear.
Danielle, his tone, Wesley Snipes' tone, seems to have changed. It was at one point much more sort of like, I'm doing this on principle, and then later became, well, I didn't really know what I was doing. Was that a little bit too late to change the game?
Well, I think that it was. I mean, Wesley is a really kind of proud, almost to the well, he's an arrogant person. I mean, let's be honest. A lot of people who've worked on him on some of his later films often complained about his level of intensity and how he would just block out other people. And yet Wesley's in Wesley's world. So I think he thought he could just, you know, kung fu kick his way, you know, through all of this. And by the time
Blade
all the
goes
heat
to
came
jail.
Down. Exactly. Blade goes to jail. Totally. And just to add, though, even though I feel like Wesley's sentence was kind of harsh compared to what they traditionally do to other celebrities, and not just Willie Nelson, but, you know, Red Fox and Richard Pryor and Sammy Davis Jr. all also got in trouble with the IRS, as well as Will Smith when he was young. You know, none of them saw a day in prison. They all got probation. So Wesley was basically being singled out because he was involved in this whole mythology that's going on in the web of this group of individuals who are arguing that legally the federal government cannot, you know, enforce these tax laws. And so therefore, they came up with all these loopholes you could use to actually steal money from the government. So they really wanted to make an example out of Wesley to sort of shoot down this ideology, but I don't think anyone expected the sentence to be that harsh.
Well, let me move on to our final topic, which is gentrification. Hundreds of people recently gathered in Harlem to protest development and gentrification of the area. Now, gentrification has come to symbolize wealthy, often white newcomers into a neighborhood displacing poor people of color, but plenty of black folks are happy to get more variety in the kinds of shops and restaurants that they have and in the public safety. Now, Carmen, Harlem was all white, you know, Dutch American before it became all black. Do you think it's going to flip again racially because of these new economic moves by city planners and real estate investors?
Well, it's bigger than just Harlem. Manhattan is flipping racially because it's becoming so exorbitantly expensive. Only the people at the highest echelons of income can afford to live anywhere in Manhattan. So, of course, people are going to spread out. But I got to tell you, from personal experience, I certainly know plenty of African American investment bankers who bought houses, brownstones in Harlem, because they couldn't afford them on the Upper West Side, so they moved up a little further, up to Harlem. My concern about the gentrification is, look, we're a capitalist country. It's going to happen. Change is going to come. But that protecting some of the character and protecting the individuals who maintain these areas when they were blighted, who lived there and raised families and created to the culture and upkept buildings to the best of their ability, so that now it is desirable for people with much more with many more resources to come in and take over. What happens to them? And I think we have to look out for those people.
Wayne, there's some of the issues that come up in a situation like that is that if you've had, say, a brownstone that was worth $200,000 in bad times and is worth $1 million now, you might not have money to pay property taxes,
right,
on the newly appreciated house. What could government do, or you know, what can anyone do to try to help out people like the folks Carmen was mentioning who stayed there through the rough times?
Right. I think the first thing is that the developers have to give fair value to the people that they're trying to buy out or they're eventually going to buy out. And I think local governments do also have to play a role. I know here in Philadelphia, we do have these revisions of the property taxes and the, you know, to make sure that the taxes are fair and equitable and people aren't priced out because they can't afford the taxes. I call it New Yorkification here in Philly, because Center City, Philadelphia, all these New York developers are just coming in, and the prices are just going through the roof for everything in and around Center City, Philadelphia. But the thing is, here in Philly at least, it's just confined to the Center City area. And I just think it's ironic because it was that a lot of affluent whites were moving to the suburbs, and now they're moving back into the cities, and that is kicking the price up. But I do think local governments can play a role. They can be a little more proactive in what they do with property taxes and so on to try to protect people at the lower end. But a lot of these people, if they get fair market value, you know, they might want to sell to developers.
Let me get Danielle in here. You get the final word. There's also been tensions between, you know, wealthy newcomers and the people who've been there, and they can be of the same race. And we see these tensions that are really about money, not about race. Whose job is it to step in on those levels and go to community board meetings and try to, you know, put some oil on the troubled waters?
Well, what I wish would happen, because we actually have a gentrification issue in St. Louis as well, what I wish would happen is that there would be more agreements between the developer, the community, and the city, the municipality, where basically they agree to create like a mixed, you know, income neighborhood where there's enough, you know, nice new housing that's affordable, that's good for working class people, as well as creating, you know, these gorgeous brownstones, or in our case, you know, we have all these great loft apartments that attract, you know, young people with money. So that way you all kind of work together. I mean, the working class people, they already work in the city. It's convenient for them to live there. I mean, they're going to be the ones, you know, who are going to use the grocery stores as well. I mean, working class people, they like to go to the restaurant. It doesn't make any sense to kind of force these people out of the neighborhood just because, you know, they're of different incomes. I feel like there should be a way to create a balance.
All right. Well, I want to thank the three of you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, no problem.
We've been talking with attorney Wayne Bennett, who blogs as The Field Negro. He was at the Audio Post Studios in Philadelphia. Danielle Belton runs the blogs Black Snob and the Secret Council of American Negroes. She was at member station KWMU in St. Louis, Missouri. And media consultant Carmen Dixon writes the blog All About Race. She was with me at the NPR West Studios. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. April is National Poetry Month. To help us celebrate, we invited California's poet laureate, Al Young, to NPR West to talk more about the art and the joys of poetry. His latest book is called Something About the Blues, an Unlikely Collection of Poetry. It's unlikely in part because it includes a CD of him reading his works, often with jazz and blues accompaniment. Mr. Young, welcome.
Thank you.
You can tell when you listen to the CD that you like what you do.
I love it.
Yeah. What do you like specifically about reading your work to an audience that makes it different, perhaps, from writing it for the page?
It's like playing music to an audience. To play the music and not feel the responsive vibration, something coming back, is meaningless to me. But what happens in a live context when you are reciting or reading your poetry, it's only partially complete when you're reading it. It's completed when it's received. And poetry is very much like music. It's vibration and frequency, and it affects us in ways that we don't altogether understand, but we know it's happening.
What kind of inspiration did it take to make you into a poet? Who did you read? When did you start reading? Or did someone read to you as a child that made you love poetry?
I started reading at the age of 3. And I like to think that it's because my parents, who were working class people who only had, both my mother and father only graduated from the 8th grade, so that they read, and they read a lot, and put their arms around me while they read. And I'm convinced that that has a lot to do with getting you to understand how to read. And I would look at their mouths, and I'd look at the page, and somehow I figured it out. Then I tortured everybody by reading every sign, everything, which I still do.
So if you had to name a few other people, and I'm sure there'd be a long list, but just one or two people who you love.
Gwendolyn Brooks, Langston Hughes, Paul Lawrence Dunbar, Kenneth Rexroth.
Some of those
Denise
names.
Denise Levertov.
Some of these names I know and some I don't. And I think there are a lot of people like me out there who like
yes.
poetry, but they don't necessarily know, they don't have a long history with
yes.
poetry.
Yes, yes.
Are you afraid that poetry is still viewed as very ivory tower for some people? Or do you think, for example, the spoken word movement has brought more people into the fold, or maybe a little bit of both?
I think the spoken word movement has brought more people into the fold. Modernism is what we're not talking about here, which is the culprit. When Mr. Eliot and Mr. Pound devised modernism for Americans, I'm curious that they should both be expatriates, they wrote in such a way that a lot of people didn't find poetry accessible, and poetry has always been popular with the people, so that poetry took refuge in colleges and universities where it had to be explained, and that's where it remains today. And our poets go to college to learn how to write poetry, and there's a built-in problem with that, in that erudition and book learning is extolled as one of the high achievements of a poet, and it can get in the way of one's poetry, because I think that experience should be the first thing on your list to pay attention to. So that modernism split when that happened. It split into the kind of academic, arcane, Mandarin modernism, you know, try and figure this out. And it went into another vein, which was populist modernism. People like Marianne Moore or Vachel Lindsay or Carl Sandburg or Langston Hughes, who use modernist techniques. Okay, we're not going to rhyme. We're not going to necessarily have a regular beat, but we're going to write stuff that you can understand. So that's the branch that I was baptized in.
I want to talk about some of your work. One of the poems in the book that's also on the CD is called Conjugal Visits.
Oh, yes.
It's just so real.
It's based on something that was real.
Tell me about it.
I was teaching in a program called Community Studies, which was an interdisciplinary program, a work-study program. You'd go to school for a while, and you'd go out and work, and then you'd come back and write about it. And there was a woman enrolled in one of my classes who had 4 kids and a husband in San Quentin, her 3rd husband, by whom she had no kids. This was in the 1980s when San Quentin was experimenting with conjugal visits. She'd say, Mr. Young, I won't be in class because it's conjugal visiting day at the Q. And so I finally asked her about it, and her body language was of 2 kinds. She was smiling and obviously joyous when she talked about how it was to go see her husband once a month. And then her body language changed, and she got very severe, and she sat up at her seat across from my desk, and she said, "And when I get back to Santa Cruz and I'm trying to do my schoolwork and take care of my kids and do my job, he can't mess with me because he locked up in the joint," and this kind of thing. And so she had obviously solved her problem. She had her man, but, you know, she didn't have to put up with him all the time. But the subtext of it is about our society's policy of just warehousing people. So it's a matter of priorities.
In your work as not just a poet, but as a teacher, what's your mission?
To remind people that we are spirit, we are essentially divine. That's been really obscured in the 20th century with so much slaughter and so much murder and homicide, a lot of it sanctioned by governments, so that we forget that we are divine. I think the ancients understood, our ancestors understood this better than we do.
It strikes me that your politics are probably somewhat different from the the man who granted you the poet laureate position, Governor Schwarzenegger,
yes,
who has called your ability to inspire something that really influenced your position. But how do you deal with obviously being someone who's very politically conscious and also operating in this world of arts and letters and in this world, this sort of quasi-governmental world, because that is part of your appointment, that to be this ambassador for the state on some level?
Not only for the state, but the State Department still sends me out abroad to represent the country, and I speak my mind, but they still send me out. I don't know how one reconciles this. I think you have to be true to yourself, and I always am, and in my initial interview with the governor, I stated my politics, and he understood it, and I didn't think he was going to appoint me, but he did anyway. So obviously something is getting across that's useful.
I wonder if you could read a poem for us.
I would love to.
You know, I love conjugal visits, but I'm sure that there's there's something else that you want to share with us. You have your poems about California, poems about the blues.
I've got one, the one called "Who I Am in Twilight." And it's a poem that is actually emblazoned on the sidewalk, and it's set in stone, as it were, on something called a poetry walk in Berkeley, California. They put down on the sidewalk, Addison Street, about 100 poets, I think, work. So it's fun to go over there and see how posterity works, because always somebody has dropped some pizza on it, mashed out a cigarette on it or something like that. So don't live for posterity, live for now. But here it is. Who I am in twilight, like John Lee Hooker, like Lightnin' Hopkins, like the blues himself, the trickster sonnet, hoedown, the tango, the cante hondo, like blessed spirituals and ragas, custom made, like sagas, like stories, like slick, slow, sly soliloquies sliding into dramas, like crime and punishment, like death and birth, Canal Street, New Orleans, like the easy, erasable, troubled voices a whirling ceiling fan makes in deep summer nights in hot, unheavenly hotels, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Tennessee, like the Mississippi River so deep and wide you couldn't get a letter to the other side, like Grand Canyon, like Yosemite National Park, like beans and cornbread, like rest and recreation, like love and like. I know we last. I know our bleeding stops.
Al Young, thank you so much.
Thank you.
California Poet Laureate Al Young. His latest book is called Something About the Blues, an unlikely collection of poetry. She was already 6 feet tall by the time she was in the sixth grade. WNBA superstar Lisa Leslie was able to turn those gangly limbs into one of the greatest female athletes in history. Last year was a big one for Leslie. She took the 2007 season off to have a baby, but now she's back with a new teammate and a new book titled Don't Let the Lipstick Fool You. Joining me in our studios at NPR West, Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited.
Tell me about when you first realized you had a passion for basketball.
That's a good question. I think I realized I truly had a passion for it by ninth grade. I started pretty late playing basketball in the seventh grade, considering, you know, I'm a professional athlete. So I think seventh grade was just kind of like, okay, I'll do it as long as I don't fall down. Eighth grade is where I really had this grueling, like, drills and really understood what it took to play basketball, because my cousin would just take me through all these drills, like sit on the wall, do push-ups, and I was thinking, okay, I just came to, like, play with the ball. And then I really realized by ninth grade, like, wow, if I really perfect this game, I could get a free scholarship and go to college, because my mom couldn't afford to send me to a four-year university. And then maybe I could possibly travel the world. So ninth grade was when I truly realized this is what I wanted to do, and I truly had a passion for it.
You talk at various points in the book about playing with boys or playing with men. What is it like to take the court? And, of course, the foreword is by Magic Johnson. And yeah. Apparently you've gone out and played with his buddies every night.
I have. In fact, in the book, Don't Let the Lipstick Fool You, it was important for me to show that it's not necessarily a basketball book, but I did give a few stories and anecdotes of when I played basketball with Magic and his team. Magic actually had a traveling team. And so it was right after he kind of retired, he would always have this team and they'd go overseas and play internationally. So I didn't go with them on trips, but when they practiced, Magic allowed me to get into the practice and he put me on his team. And it was great because they treated me like one of the guys, but were very respectful. But I was just like, don't go easy on me. You know, I would play like a two guard because I'm 6'5". And in the NBA, 6'5 is the point guard or the two guard versus, you know, in the WNBA, 6'5", we're the forward and the centers. So the positions are pretty different, but it allowed me to become much more versatile, a lot stronger, reading the defense. And Magic, I mean, Magic is Magic. He's great. If you have the opportunity to play with him, I mean, you take that. So he was so great with letting me train with them every single day, and I just come show up on time, warm up on the side, and jump into the drills.
Let me back up a little bit. You, in this book, have a lot of your childhood, including the pretty phenomenal story of how your mother decided to be a long-haul trucker. How did that affect your life as a child?
As a kid, I think I became... One, I grew up pretty fast because I had to become very responsible for my little sister, who we're 8 years apart. So I was about, you know, 9 and 10 years old, taking care of a 2-year-old, and also I think it really helped me to be a little bit more protective and streetwise, because we lived in Compton, California, and we had to kind of, I wouldn't use the word walk the streets, but I mean, you have to kind of cross into the main street to get to church, to get to the liquor store, you know, to get to the fish market where we used to go get French fries. So everything kind of put you out there in the neighborhood where you had to learn the ropes of the neighborhood. So I'd say it did force me to grow up a little fast, but in a good way, where I was wise. You know, my sister and I, we'd cross the street, stay, you know, near the lights if it got dark, on our way home, get inside the house, you know, when it got too dark, hanging out with the right people. You had to make decisions at an early age because my mom wasn't there to say, you know, this is who you play with, this is who you don't play with. It was kind of like we had to do that on our own. And when you have to make those decisions, I just think at a young age, I had to see the world a little bit sooner than some kids do. Some kids are not conscious of what's going on.
As you moved through life, into college ball, through the Olympics, into the WNBA, how do you think your mindset about the world changed, or how did you change?
Well, I think different incidents made me more aware that I think at first I was very secluded in the sense I didn't realize like there was an Olympics and that, you know, like other countries were coming and playing sports and, you know, the wars and stuff other than what you learned in school. It just didn't quite click in that these people and areas still existed. So I think as I grew up and got a chance to play basketball and travel the world, like you said, I became so much more aware of culture and my own culture and what I was missing in my own culture, and also what I didn't have any idea of other people's culture. And then I think secondly was, you know, I became so much more of racism, which I wasn't, I think, in California, you know, again, I think I was just in my own world, you know, being in inner city, I was around a lot of blacks, Hispanics, a few white people that are in my own family, because we have a very mixed family as well. So I never really looked at people or was taught, you know, about so many differences that caused so much racial tension.
We got a chance to talk to Coach Vivian Stringer about her memoir, which came out. And she had been through family illnesses and the death of her husband and all these things. But she said that the comment, the Don Imus comment about nappy-headed hoes, referring to her team at Rutgers, was the toughest thing she'd been through. How did you feel when that statement was made and hit the news?
I felt saddened again. I felt like, wow, are you serious? Like, here we are in 2007, and once again, I don't know if at times we, and I say we, I don't know if Black people or just we Californians or we some people just feel like, wow, we've really passed that point. Like, it doesn't really exist, or you don't experience it so much that I guess when we do experience it, you're just like, you feel like you have to take another step back.
What do you see coming up? You've done modeling, been to the Olympics. You know, obviously, you're a wife and mother. What do you see coming up for you?
I have the Lisa Leslie Basketball Academy, which is great because I never wanted to lend my name without being able to give back to the youth myself. And this is a place where the kids can come out and play, and they will be able to learn and go through drills. And I also have a camp. Also, I see me doing public speaking. I really think that our youth needs to hear positive stories like mine and just see that it doesn't matter what your situation is at home. I come from a single parent. You know, everything wasn't all hunky-dory at home. We didn't always have money, but we had love and we've had, you know, our goals set. My mom's always told us that we can be anything. And I think that it's important for kids, no matter what their situation is, to hear those stories. So public appearances, I like doing that and speaking. Again, I would love to win a fourth gold medal because, well, that's just what I do. So I'm looking forward to going back to Beijing and hopefully winning a fourth gold medal. And I don't know, maybe more deals or something that makes money and helps people. I love that.
Well, we've loved having you on. Lisa, thanks so much.
Yes, thanks for having me.
That was L.A. Spark superstar Lisa Leslie. She's author of a new book, Lisa Leslie, Don't Let the Lipstick Fool You, and she joined us in our studios here at NPR West.